protection,
and that is a group under the composition of the that were approved in the term of Kaylee. Again, it's one of those terms that was approved about group theory before
they had the definition.
He said, oh, Kaylee might have had a definition of group, abstract definition of group in his mind. And so, but he saw every group as a subgroup of group representation, which is how groups were looked at before. So I guess Kaylee was a group. Mid late 19th century, and people like Lagrange, Abel, Galois, all the people work in groups, but they always thought about groups as being this guy, the subgroups of this guy. And Kaylee's theorem which is very easy, is that every group is a subgroup, is isomorphic to the subgroup. So actually, I'm going to prove more. In fact, G is isomorphic to a subgroup of G. So you can think of any group as a subgroup of the group of permutations of the underlying set. Of course, it might not be the most economical way of representing a group as a group of permutations, so later on we want to talk about symmetric groups, we're going to see lots of others. So, by the way, a homomorphism F from G to X is called a permutation representation of G. So given a group G, for example, a finite group G, then if it's a finite group G, you can represent it as sim inside sim X or some finite set X. And you might just ask yourself, what's the smallest X that you can get? So what's the smallest permutation representation? And then things become more interesting, you can sort of be more economical in the way of representing groups as group of permutations. But of course it becomes harder. The optional value. But let's prove this, because this is very easy. So given G in G, define a function P sub G by P sub G of X is G times X. This is translation by G. So that's a function from G to G, right? Because any x multiplied by G can run around with G. Any x, big G, you can multiply it by little g, and get another element of big G. So, it's a function. But moreover, it's a bijection. PG inverse is PG inverse. That should be clear, right? So if you multiply by G and then multiply by G inverse, multiply X by G and multiply the result by G inverse, you get X back. So this. The function that you get by using the element the inverse of the group is the inverse function of PG. So, this shows that this function is a bijective. So, P sub G is M G. That is a bijection of G and an inverse. So, we have an F. So then that G, so we call, I don't know, you have to call it capital G, is a map from G to chain G, that can G to the group to G. And now the claim is that circle G is an injective homomorphism. And that's what proves that is here, right? Exhibiting the exact homomorphism. So how do we prove it's a homomorphism? So we want to show that P of GH, what is this? This is P, be careful, P G of PH. P of GH, by definition, is PGH. Right? That's the definition. You take capital P and you have of an element of the group, and you use the function little P with respect to the element. What does this function do? PGH of X is GH of X, which you can write as G times H of X, which is G of pH of X, which is CG of pH of X. Right? So this is actually CG of pH, which is the operation in this group is composition, so this is CG. Yes. Right, so this gives me this, which gives me the capital P of the world. Why is it injective? What's the kernel? Kernel GG is the set of GG such that PG is identity. But if PG is an identity, then PG equals identity implies PG of E, for example, has to be E. But what is PG of E? It's GE. Which is G. Translation gives you. There are many other ways of
making a group act on itself, some of which can, you know, be ejected. So they're all maps from Jesus can be used. So we can act on a group by itself. Like conjugation, that's another one. Some other interesting stuff. So we will see others. Permutation representation. A nice consequence of this term, which maybe is one of its main uses is to give a finite group every finite group is isomorphic to a subgroup of U, L, and R. Actually, you can replace it by any group KN. The same group works for any field, so anybody makes a group of any field, you've got the same group, you know, if you want to take K to be R. So all the group does. In homomorphism, F from G to GRM K is called a linear representation. So representation is a generic name for representing a group, so making a group all concrete, so taking an abstract group and making it concrete, like functions or linear maps. Making a group representing a group of linear transformations called a linear representation. Okay, so how do we prove this? This is a group of finite groups. There is a corresponding statement for infinite groups. But then you have to take into dimensional vector spaces, maybe. So let's leave it like that. Okay, so how are we going to prove this? Well, by Gandhi's theorem, you can map G to sin G. So I'm going to take one of these guys and embed this guy in G, L, and that's going to be all. So, no. G, L, and K, where K is a cardinal of K, M. Okay, so all I have to treat is the symmetric group, so I've got to prove that this guy embedded in GLM and then this guy is not embedded in some component. So, group of symmetric group on a finite set, they're all isomorphic, depending on the cardinality of the set, so after the bad band, this is the same. This guy's one hand, right? And that set is, so if G has n elements, then sin G is isomorphic to that set. I just think of my ejection between G and the set of into this one plan, just a numbering, and then you replace by any by projection by 20 bucks of ink. So that's enough to embed the rule in that rule. So find a map XM into GLM with, okay? And here's the map. Actually, if you done one of the problems I assigned for homework, you have seen this map, maybe in some disguised form, because it shows up there. But you define a map from F, so let me define a map in, so given sigma, okay, so given sigma in Xn, define a linear transformation A sigma that is going to go from Kn to Kn by sending x1, x2, etc. So now that in n-dimensional space is just an n-double coordinate, and what I'm going to do to the n-double coordinate is permute them around by plotting to the permutation given by the integer. So this element here is a bijection from this set itself. So it's a permutation of the indices 1 up to n. So we can do this. So each of these guys is a coordinate. So you just because here it's a linear map, so if you add two vectors and permute the coordinate of the sum, it's the same thing as permuting the coordinate of each momentum and adding it. This is going to be a linear transformation. So this is an element of yeah. I'll leave it as an exercise for you, but you write down the matrix. And then it's easy to see that A sigma tau is A sigma A tau, so sigma goes to A sigma to go home. And it's clearly exactly right, if the permutation is not trivial, it's doing something with the coordinate, so if you take a vector that has, say, 1, 1, and all zeros, and you take a with a 1 in place of the sigma move, you're going to lose the vector. That that is my group is isomorphic to subgroup. We're going to use it. Again, you can ask, is this the most economic way to represent, to linearly represent a group? And the answer is usually no. You know, you have a finite group, you want to write it as a subgroup of the matrix group. Often you're not going to have a group of order. Say for example, if you take S3 is a group of order 6. So they take S3 is a group of order 6, and this thing is representing if it's inside of GL3. The order doesn't matter, but the point is that as an example of this construction, you're getting S3 being represented as 3 by 3 matrix. There is a way of representing S3 as 2 by 2 matrix. So if you think of an equilateral triangle and the group of symmetries of the equilateral triangle, they all come from linear transformations of the plane, right? You can rotate the triangle or you can do reflections around the median, right? So that's the, and it's clear this gives you S3, right? If you have the rotations, that's three of them, and then reflection, so you get all the three things by composing, and so you have, so S3 can be embedded in GL2. So it's all the, so symmetry. triangle, or equilateral triangle, is a group isomorphic to F3 inside of GL2.
So, although this proof of the theorem gives you a representation in GL3, you can be more economic when having it in GL2.
You cannot put F3 in GL1.
So you cannot do it better than this. And can anybody tell me why?
Not commutative.
Huh? Yes. So the question was, can you put F3 inside of GL1? One by one matrices. And one by one matrices is just one number, right? And the operator is multiplication. So this group here is commutative. It's a bit. And F3 is not a bit. So you cannot give that F3 inside of one. So, yes.
So for example, S4, you could end up instead of GL3, but not GL2.
Actually, isn't there anything else? You can certainly get in GL3 by symmetry of Catalina. But I think...
So in order to get a reflection, you have to go into, you have to go into the 3 space. Right? You can rotate in plane, but to get a reflection, you have to go into the dimension.
So you're thinking about the square?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the student doesn't need the information, right?
Oh, that's right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I think S4 is similar to the square. Yeah. So should S4 also embed in the LTA? I think I'm going to S5.
It's not similar to the square if we change only 2 points.
Yeah. Ah, yeah. Okay. It's at the end of the point. The similar to the square is a subgroup of S4, but you cannot change 2. Versus and keep 2 is back. There's no way. So, but there is an embedding of S4 in GL2. I know that F5 does not embed in GL2. That's so that's, you know, at some point you have to grow. I mean, the smallest N that you can embed the final group is going to grow with the size of the group. But, well, we know what the finite subgroups of GL2 are. I mean, this is not an easy thing to do, but you can list them all. And F5 is not one of them. So, actually, so the finite subgroups of GL2, I may be wrong, but I think it's, it's sort of obvious things like that. F3, S4, A5, I think A5 embeds in GL2 also, and then there's the cyclic group of other ends, rotations on a polygon, and then you can also reflect on a polygon to get a dihedral group of other ends. So there, you have infinitely many subgroups of GL2, infinitely many finite subgroups of GL2, but there are only 2 families, so there's the cyclic groups and the dihedral groups, and then the finite things. So you can classify all the finite subgroups of GLN. So one way to tell if a group does not embed in GLN is just look through the list. But you have to have the list in the first place, which is not something easy to, not something easy to can do. I actually don't know how hard it is to prove directly that S5 does not embed in GL2. Maybe there's a trick. I haven't actually never sat down to do it, so I don't really know. I know from general facts, but there might be some truth. Okay. All right. So that's what I wanted to say about representations for now. I want to sort of mention something that I'm not going to use in the rest of the course, and in some ways it's contrary to the philosophy of the course, but I suppose it's in some sense it's full disclosure. So I should mention this. So one of the sort of things that we're going to be doing a lot, is classifying groups. That's what is isomorphism. So if you have a group and you know something about a group, you want to describe a group against a sort of list of known groups. For example, you already know that every cyclic group of prime order is cyclic, right? So that's a classification. On P prime is isomorphic. So that's a classification report. So it says that two groups, you know, a group, you know, given you know something about a group, that's its order of prime, you get that the group is isomorphic to something in the finite thing. And from the point of view of this part, this is very good because we sort of know everything about this group. This group is very easy to understand. You know how to operate on it, you know. For example, it doesn't have any subgroups except this group. Two of these ones and so on. So that's going to be the point of view we're going to have throughout the course. We're going to be using isomorphism, you know, there are like two groups of isomorphism, we're going to consider them as identical. So if you know everything about the one, you know everything about the other. But what I wanted to mention now is that just because you know the two groups are isomorphic doesn't mean that you can compute the isomorphism. And that sometimes, even if you know that the groups are isomorphic, to make them be identical is somewhat misleading. And so here's a theorem from number theory. C is prime, which I'm not going to prove, by the way, but you might have seen that in another theory class. I'm not going to use it now. Maybe it will be proved to you in the next semester, because it fits very nicely when you talk about finite fields. But you look at the integers mod p, remove the zero, so the group of integers mod, non-zero integers mod p under multiplication, so you make it as a group under multiplication, this group is 6. So that means that it's isomorphic, hence isomorphic. So let's be very anal here and say under multiplication and be under addition. Okay? So just take clear all the operations up. So here the operation is the non-zero residue classes mod P under multiplication. This is all the residue classes modulo P minus 1 under addition. And the theorem says that this two groups are isomorphic. I'm not going to prove the theorem. You can believe, you can check, you know, to take peak of 13, you can verify by hand. 6 to 1 as well. However, so what would be a right? So what does it mean? It means that there is a map that extends n to some. Oh, okay. So in fact, it says that there's a generator. So there's a generator G, so that this map is not isomorphic. So there exists a G. And, you know, although there are some issues about finding the generators. Sometimes it's not so trivial, but it can be done, it's not so hard. You know, you can test a few elements and look for one and you end up finding them. But the funny thing is, so in principle, given G and H in Z mod P, so given H, so let's fix the G. So G is the generator. I don't know. as a group of cyclic triadic areas, or a mix of areas. So given agency what is a star, we know there exists an N which G to the N equals X. Right, that's what the theorem is saying. You know, if you have to fix a generator and it's a generator, then given any other element of the group, it's a part of the generator. Just going around here is not saying anything. The funny thing is, it can be very hard to compute M. So given that even if you know B and G and H, and these numbers are very big, then it might be very hard to compute M. Given knowing P, G, and H, it might be hard. And this is actually used in cryptography, so this is a way of hiding some secrets. So the N can be a secret. And, you know, it's actually, you know, there are industrial applications and, you know, governments and companies and stuff use this to hide secrets. So it's actually, it is true, it can be hard. And, I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, the notion of isomorphism, you know, you can get too attached to it, and sometimes it's not, you know, two things are isomorphic, they are essentially identical, but sometimes getting the match, so computing this map, well, I actually computed the inverse, so this map is easy to calculate. The problem is going backwards. Okay, so exponentiating is easy. The hard thing is to compute. This is called the discrete log problem, finding the N, and that's hard. But I don't really want to go into that direction because that's not the subject of the course. But I wanted you to be aware. Yeah.
Do you know if it's an NT hard problem?
It's not known. It's NT, but it's...
I don't think it's known.
Yeah, so in theory, it could be, there could be, you know... It could conceivably happen that there would be a breakthrough that makes the thing fall known. Hopefully, if you don't believe the T equals NT. Okay, but even if you don't, it's still conceivable that you can find a polynomial of time algorithm for this problem, which is not a solution. It does, which is not a general solution. I don't think the problem is easy. It's NP. Well, there's not, you know, not that we know. Okay, I wanted to spend the last 15-20 minutes switching gears and talking about something very abstract, which I'm going to, because again it's not something that we're going to use much in rhetoric class, although sometimes we hear buzzwords and don't know exactly what they mean, and it's useful to at least know what they mean. And one thing I want to talk about is categories, and because it's, you know, mathematicians like to talk about category of this and the category of that, and it's useful to know what these words mean and what good does it do to us. So, I'm just going to, so it's going to be a very quick introduction to the idea of a category without intention of being covering the subject, and you're just going to use it mostly as shorthand. We'll be clear in a moment. So, very quick introduction. So what's our category? Consists of the following. So one is a collection of objects of C. So category C, strict C category. So it's going to have a collection of objects which you can think of all C as a set, although sometimes it's not even a set, it's a big collection. But all C is just a set for us. The set. So you should keep in mind one example of a category is the category of all groups. So I'm going to be, so that in this case here, the objects will be the groups themselves. Each group is an object in the category. But just saying what groups are is not enough to describe the category. One thing that is very important is how you relate those groups to another, and we've been talking about homomorphisms, and that's why I want to use this category now, because an algebraic structure like groups is not just the actions that define the object, but you also want a description of the map between them. So how are you going to compare two objects? And in the case of groups, you compare them by homomorphisms and identify them by isomorphisms. So the category of groups comes equipped not only with the collection of objects themselves, but a notion of morphisms. So there is, for each pair, AB of objects, a set CAB called the morphism of the category of groups, for each two groups, this is going to be the set of homomorphisms from A to B. So in the case of groups, C and B is the homomorphism group A. And the third thing is that, homomorphisms can be composed. So we want a law of composition. So for any A, B, C in objects, a law composition, so a law composition, so the way of composing functions, so we just abstract these, you have a function from A to B and a function from B to C, you want to get a function from A to C. But, a category doesn't have to be the morphisms don't necessarily have to be functions. In most examples, they will be functions. So in most examples, the objects will see will be sets of some kind, or great structures of some kind. The morphisms are going to be functions, and the law of compositions is going to be compositional functions. But in the general definition of category, you don't require it. Okay, so this is just a function from this computer problem over there, and but we have to require some properties, such that, so three problems. First thing, when we learn about functions, we learn that for two functions to be the same, they have to have the same source and the same target and send the same elements, same thing. So here again, two functions can only be compared if they have the same source and same target. So if AB is different from A prime B prime, so if you have a pair of force target, which is different from another pair of force target. I want the map from A to B, if you will, to never be the same as the map from A to B. For two, functions to be the same, or to be called even, you know, if you even have a whole of them being the same, they have to be, they have the same source, same target, so this is a trivial thing. Data things, things that I want, so the main axiom is that this block of position has to be associated. So, and what does it mean? So that's, so this is just a trivial thing. The important thing, the main thing about category is that you want that this law position to be associated. So what I'm going to say is that the map. So there's a first way of saying that. So okay, so if you introduce a notation, let me say FG, and this is of course to FG. Right? So you want and whenever. So, by the way, so you have, the function may have different domains, so F in C, A, B, G in C, B, C, and H in C, C, D, we want, we'll have, we have F, G, H, so F. So that's the way of stating the associativity of the normal position. Here's a fancy way, equivalently. So if you haven't seen a commutative diagram before, you're going to see your first commutative diagram. Following that information. There's a confusing thing. The commutative diagram represents the associativity. The words I use. So, if you have this guy, and this guy, and you have a triple in here, so I don't know this guy, I don't know this guy, I don't know this guy, you can compose, you know, can use the law of composition to compose the first two guys. So you get a map right, so this is a, so to call this map mu sub AB ABC. So this is going to be mu sub ABC cross the identity in D. And then you can also go from this guy to, you compose those two guys first. And then you, so this is going to go to CAB to CD. And that's the function identity in A. No, identity not in G, identity in C, C, D. If you don't want to copy. Cross mu D. Now in here you have, so to be able to compose things you have to have the same thing in the middle, right? So you can compose and get this from here to here. So that's going to be mu ACD. And here you can go mu ABD. So compose from here to here. So the diagram commutes. So there are four arrows that you get. So from the existence of the law of composition, you can make this four arrows, right? And in this diagram. So just the mere existence of this law of composition allows you to built the dagger. And the statement is a dagger for use means that going this way is the same as going this way. So that's what this axiom means. So this you can denote it like that. And written in fancy language means that mu A B D composed with mu A B C cross identity C C D. That's why some people call that category theory, because it has a crazy notation. It's the same as mu A C. That is essentially as mu A B D composed mu or identity of C A cross mu. And we're not done yet. And also, so the composition law is associative, and another condition is that there is an identity. So for all A in object of C, there exists a function 1A in CAA. So there's always, for every object there is an identity function from A to A. And said that for all F in CAB, you can compose 1A F, 1A F, and 1B F. I guess I'm doing the right way. Alright? Hope I am. That is definitely the right way. So, there is an identity. So, identity function is just, because this doesn't have to be functions, but it's mimicking the ideal functions, we define that the identity to be something composed with anything else. So, A D, we have 1 F, so it's F composed with 1. Okay, and you can make a diagram to represent this. You have C, A, B, okay, so examples, just give me 3 minutes to write up an example. So C is groups. So the category of groups, yes? The morphisms are all the functions.
Okay. And you can make all the categories like abelian groups. So again, homomorphisms are. And you can make vector spaces. Well, so a lot of my searches, there's a category of that type of research. Yeah?
Is the one function that's going to be the identity function?
Yeah, in those examples, the one function is going to be the identity function. And the log composition is more important. For an example of a category that is much made up of sets and functions, think, suppose I have a group. I'm going to make a category that has only one object, say, the group. And the morphisms are, so if the category has only one object, A, is the only object, I only have to tell you what CA is. Right? So the one, so I'm going to take, so if I have a group G, I'm going to take a category with one object, which I'll call A, I'm going to call the morphisms CA, because then I have a log composition. Right? I have to give you a map from here times here back to here, and since I only have one choice for A, B, and C, just A, to give a category with one object, which is with one to G, I have to give you a map from G cross C to G, which has to be associative and have an identity. So a category with one object is a semigroup. So it is just one object, one set of morphisms, a log composition on the morphisms that is associative and has an identity. So a category, any same group gives you a category with one object, a category with one object is the same group. A group, yeah, you don't have that. Okay. So that's what you can do. Just one last example, you can take a category of, say, differentiable manifolds. And as morphisms, the smooth maps. So that's also a category. So the whole point is that proposition of smooth maps is smooth, which is what you're learning how.
But,
so, you know, all, you know, even sort of topological notions, all these things, topological spaces from our category, so, you know, all these things that we see a lot in math often sort of come as a package, you know, sets and the maps between them. So topology is about continuous functions or smooth functions, and, you know, measure theory is about measurable functions, and so on. So, you know, you always have a structure and a function on this, and that's what the notion of category correct and what. Okay, so I'm going to...